Okay. Could you close the door, please? Thank you. I'm going to open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on February 20th, 2013. And, well, since there's not enough people here.
Do I get to start first?
No, because we don't. Do we need a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Five of us?
Yeah, one more.
Yeah, okay. Do we? Five?
Quorum.
Nine. Don't wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've got a quorum.
I gotta go.
Sit there. Okay, colleagues, we have several committee bills. The first batch of committee bills will be from our own committee. Another committee had not put in the notification that they were going to have possible introduction of committee measures, so we're going to present some for another committee. So, Representative
Olson,
thank you. I'm going to open the introduction of committee measures.
Chair, may I move that the following legislative concepts, LC drafts, be introduced into the committee as committee bills. First one is LC 3411, dated 1-30-13. Next one is LC 2962, dated 1-8-13. LC 425, dated 2-7-13. And LC 1043, dated 9-17-12.
So the Vice Chair has moved that LC 3411, dated 1-30-13, LC 2962, dated 1-8-13, LC 425, dated 2-7-13, LC 1043, dated 9-17-12, be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? There's no commitment on your part that you will vote for these bills. If no objection, these concepts are introduced as committee bills. Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced on behalf of the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee for the purpose of getting them printed and into the record. That would be LC 3216, dated February 15th, LC 3313, dated February 6th, and then a series of LCs all dated on February 11th. That would be LC 3334, 3335, 3336, 3337, and 3338.
The Vice Chair moves that the following LCs be introduced on behalf of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Obviously, again, there is no commitment on your part to vote for these bills if they even come to our committee. LC 3216, dated February 15, 2013. LC 3313, dated February 6, 2013. LC 3334, dated February 11, 2013. LC 3335, dated February 11, 2013. LC 3336, dated February 11, 2013. LC 3337, dated February 11th, and LC 3338, dated February 11th, 2013. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
What do you think of 3313?
I'm not really in favor of
Thank
it. But
you. That's
let's
helpful.
Just, yeah,
I appreciate that.
That's great. Thank you. Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing none, the measure are introduced as committee bills. Thank you. And for anybody in the audience who doesn't understand what's going on, we don't either. So forgive us. So with that, we will open up a work session on House Bill 2082.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2082 has no revenue impact statement, a minimal fiscal impact statement. It modifies definitions related to social work and the composition of the State Board of Licensed Social Workers.
Great.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that House Bill 2082 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2082 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Excused.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
Excused.
Vice Chair Gomber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill will be sent to the floor, right?
That's right.
Thank you.
This is the one that he just introduced.
Yeah, Carrier.
Oh, yes. Would Joe?
Sure, I'd be happy.
Terrific. Representative Gallegos will carry that to the floor. Thank you. Committee, I was hoping that would be a legislator. Seeing not, we will close the work session on House Bill 2082.
Thank you.
She's a beautiful member of the family. Okay, we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2165.
House Bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2165 has no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact statement. It repeals the sunset on county multidisciplinary teams that respond to allegations of abuse of adults with disabilities.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are we moving the amendment in there that adds the date?
Yes. You want to make that motion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2165.
Representative Gelta moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2165. Any discussion? You want to tell us briefly what that amendment does, Representative Gelta?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We did get some feedback that it would be helpful since they are required to provide an annual report to give them a date on which to make that annual report. So that date is no later than July 1st of each year.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Did we just move, we haven't moved the dash one amendments.
Oh, we haven't yet.
Yeah, right. Do you want to do that?
I just moved the dash one amendment.
Did you?
Okay.
I don't know that we adopted the dash one amendment.
Okay, so the Representative Gelser moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2165. Any discussion?
Objection?
Thank you. Objection. Thank you. Seeing done, we move the dash one amendment to the House Bill 2165.
Objecting your own amendment.
Okay.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2165 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative Olson moves that House Bill 2165 as amended to the floor with a due recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, you and I have kind of had a little bit of discussion. I've not had the opportunity to talk to Representative Gelser about this. From what the original bill was and what your intent was on this, for giving a length of time for the MDTs to be put together and then to report back, I'm wanting to try to kind of stay true to what that intent was initially from what the bill was originally. And now that we're kind of shortening the time period and just closing it in on, I think Representative Gelser was six counties that still hadn't complied. I have some concern with that, but again, my feeling is to stay true to what the original intent of the bill was when this was all crafted initially, and therefore I'm going to be a no on the bill.
Okay, thank you for letting us know. Okay, then it probably isn't appropriate for you to move to the bill, is it? Maybe we should have
no,
it. Is it?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Already have.
You already did.
Yeah, already have. We're just waiting for
okay.
the
right
now. Discussion, Madam Chair?
Yes, further discussion.
Madam Chair, do we know which counties those six are?
I bet Representative Gelser does.
I do. All right. One moment, please. I've got to reacquaint myself. Okay. Columbia.
Gilliam.
Jefferson. Morrow. Sherman. And Wheeler is in progress, and that is for the compliance with having the MDT team. And then those that haven't yet adopted the required protocol are possibly Benton, Clatsop, possibly Coos, Crook, possibly Curry, possibly Lane, possibly Lincoln, possibly Lynn, possibly Malheur, possibly Umatilla, possibly Union, possibly Wallowa, and Yamhill.
Okay. Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to repeat a comment that I made, our commitment to this issue, obviously, and the reporting very serious abuse remains, and I appreciate your work on it. And it was just my sort of carrot and stick comment. I just want to repeat it now. Repealing the sunset is to encourage these counties and to acknowledge many counties have difficulty with infrastructure. They're not ignoring the issue necessarily, but I think by, I'll say, keeping the pressure on and having a date certain for the report, we do that. But as long as people understand, at least my intent, is to give them another opportunity to put the team together.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Representative Wisnant, did you have more to say about this?
Well, I need clarification. I'm sorry, I wasn't in a committee that, you know, we passed this. I remember passing it on the bill. We have one in Bend, in our kids center, for the children. I'm not sure about the adults. I'm not sure what we've done in that. But I'm like Representative Gilliam. I just want to be sure that, you know, we're not stopping the progress. We want them to continue to work it, even though that's to get come up with this, the teams. So.
Yes. So, Representative Wisnant, Deschutes County has an active MDT team coordinated by the DA and has adopted the protocol and has all of the people participating in their MDT that the statute calls for. And the difference between the kids MDT, this was just to bring those together and make sure that you have those DD and mental health and elderly folks there for these vulnerable adult MDTs.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other questions? All right, good. Debbie, you want to call the roll?
Representative Gallego?
Aye.
Representative Yelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinnegar?
Aye.
Representative Wisnant?
Need to be enough.
Do we know? Did she call in? Oh.
Aye.
Oh, Wisnant, okay. I thought
Wisnant.
Wisnant is aye.
Representative Wisnant?
Excuse?
Representative or Vice Chair
Bomber? Aye.
No. No, he said no.
Negative.
And Chair
Tolman? Yes. Would that be...
Madam Chair?
Yes. I didn't say no. I was repeating that he had said no, so Debbie didn't hear. He needs all the help he can get.
I'd like to change my vote from yay to nay.
Okay, how do we do that?
We haven't gaveled out yet, so.
Okay, all right. All right.
Nay, please.
All right. With that, the measure passes, and we will close the... Oh, who would like to carry this? Representative Gelson? Great. Okay. With this?
Oh, you carry it.
House Bill, we close the hearing. There's a work session on House Bill 2165, and we open up the public, or the work session on House Bill 2676.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2676, there was a revenue statement issued and no fiscal impact. It removes the sunset for mandatory cancellation of property tax assessment for manufactured structures valued less than $12,500 in some counties.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd move House Bill 2676 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to revenue.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2676 to the floor with the due pass recommendation that it be referred by prior referral to the Committee on Revenue. Any discussion? Representative Gumber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had asked some questions during the hearing about the option of extending this opportunity to other counties and did a little further research on that, the indication being that for technical reasons that I won't go into now, that that's not an option. And I just want to make it clear that I did check that out, but I support the bill as it stands right now.
Great. Thank you very much. Any further discussion? With that... staff will call the roll, please.
Representative
Gallego? Aye. Representative Johnson? Aye. Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinnegar?
Aye.
Representative Wisnant?
Aye.
Representative Wisnant?
Excuse?
Vice Chair Bomber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tolman?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent to the Committee on Revenue. Thank you. close up the work session on House Bill 2676, and we will open up an informational hearing on child welfare, and this will be invited testimony only. So I think Erin Kelly Seal is here. Well, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services. And with me today is Jerry Weybrandt. Mr. Weybrandt is the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and our self-sufficiency programs within the department. I just want to start by thanking the committee for the opportunity to be here today. As the state child agency devoting to protecting children, we in DHS are rightfully held to a very high standard around the body of work we're going to focus in on today. When things go wrong, we often share our failures and our heartache very publicly. And all too often, the successes that we achieve on behalf of our children are don't make it into the newspaper or into the calls that you're getting from constituents in your office. So we appreciate the opportunity today to better acquaint you with some of the successes that are happening in this state right now in our child welfare programs. We are appreciative of the chance to focus in on the statewide the statewide perspective, knowing that this is an area of work that that people have very strong opinions about. For us in government, we really appreciate that our responsibility in this work is weighty and serious. We believe that our intervention in child welfare is one of last resort, and that needs to be taken very, very seriously. So we are very proud of the fact, actually, to be able to share data with you that shows that child welfare in Oregon is on the right track. Are we perfect? No. Have we been getting better over the last 5 years in terms of our work on behalf of children and families? We believe we have data today that we're going to share with you that will demonstrate that we are. So with that, I just want to go through just some basic information. Some of this I'm definitely not going to read, but I just wanted to be sure to ground folks in what it is that we do and what we mean when we talk about child welfare services. Like all Oregonians, we certainly hope that abuse and neglect never happens to children. But the role of the system that we're going to talk about today is a responsive and remedial role as opposed to a system whose responsibility it is to prevent abuse. In other words, when we get involved in conversations with families, there is an allegation that abuse or neglect has already occurred. And legally, we cannot become involved with that family until we have reasonable cause to believe that that has actually happened. So we look forward and are actively participating and engaging in conversations about child abuse prevention, but that isn't the focus of the child welfare system. The child welfare system is a response system, and we'll talk a little bit about what that looks like today. We have established some very clear goals for this program area, and they are focusing in on the safety of children, the stability of families, the health and well-being of children that are in our care and custody, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we move forward. And it is always our goal that if we do not have to become involved, that we don't get involved, as long as we can ensure and provide you the reassurance that if we've gotten a call that says that someone's worried about a child and that call rises to the level of an allegation of abuse or neglect and that it may be occurring, that we take that call seriously and we take our responsibility to protect that child very, very seriously. The next slide really illustrates why it's important that we do this work and why we need to have both the conversation about our response to abuse and neglect as well as the conversation about prevention. It has been well documented now by scientists who are much smarter than I that trauma in the early ages affects an individual throughout their lifespan. And so as we talk about the impact of trauma on children, we're actually also having a conversation about public safety and corrections. We're having a conversation about educational achievement. We're having a conversation about poverty and prosperity. All of these things are interrelated, and there is hard evidence that demonstrates that. And it's why our organization has been partnering differently with communities and across programs to be both about getting ahead of trauma and having a trauma-informed practice when trauma has occurred. This next slide is designed to illustrate for you just the scope of work in Oregon around responding to allegations of abuse and neglect. In 2011, we got over 74,000 reports of abuse or neglect. We conducted over 32,000 assessments based on those reports, and 3,825 children were removed from their homes because of abuse or neglect. What you can see here is something that actually we believe is a really good thing. We get many, many calls about abuse or neglect, and we actually, and the number of calls, if you look at our 2011 data book, which is on our website, and we've been giving you all, each of your offices, a connection electronically to this. If you look at our data book, over the course of the last decade, reports of abuse in the state have been increasing, and we actually think that that's a really good thing. If someone has a concern about a child, we'd like to know about it. However, what that does present for us in our system can be a double-edged sword, because sometimes those concerns don't rise to the level legally that we can intervene. And so part of what has happened in our system over time is this is a serious conversation about what happens to those calls that we screen out that don't qualify as abuse or neglect. What are we doing for those families? And that the answer to that question really doesn't lie in the hands of child welfare, and I don't think you want it to. You want child welfare to have a very narrow and limited focus, but I believe we also want to have that other conversation. If someone's so concerned about a child that they made a call to us, then we may also want to be having another conversation about what are some of the family stressors and how could we maybe get ahead of some of that trauma with that family. In the end, though, when you look at what is driving abuse or neglect, we include this information for a couple of reasons. Many people perceive that most abuse and neglect in this state is actually physical or sexual abuse, and that's in fact not true. Most of what is happening, and this is true nationwide, is that this system, which was originally created as an intervention system for physical and sexual abuse, has become a system that's having a conversation about neglect and threat of harm. And of course, neglect is a form of abuse that takes quite a long time to actually cause harm to a child and therefore warrant our intervention. And what this data demonstrates for you is really that the impact that neglect is having on kids and families in our state, and it'll highlight for you some of our forward thinking about where we think we can have the greatest impact as a system moving forward, and why we believe that our practice needs to start to look different. Intentional harm to a child, intentional physical abuse, intentional sexual abuse is very different than neglect that occurs because a parent is addicted to drugs or alcohol. And most often in our system, that's the conversation that we're having. Something very serious has happened to a child, but it's happened because the parent's life has deteriorated and the circumstances surrounding that family have deteriorated to such a degree that there is neglect occurring. And most often the neglect is happening because of drug and alcohol addiction, domestic violence, or intervention with law enforcement. The other data points here that I just wanted to call to your attention involve the TANF program. We appreciated you having the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family conversation last Monday. That program is both an employment program and a children's program. And one of the things our agency has been focused on in the last several years is looking at what is the crossover between those families that are living in extreme poverty on TANF and those families who we end up having to intervene with because of abuse or neglect of their child. Now, please don't hear me to say that people living in poverty are always hurting their children, because that is not my message here today. But there is documented evidence that shows that a child that's living in poverty is 22 times more likely to experience abuse or neglect than a child who's not living in poverty. And when you look at our TANF data, you can see that a significant percentage, 36% in one quarter of children entering the child welfare system had been on TANF in the previous 2 months, which for us means we missed an opportunity with that child and family in the TANF program to prevent the trauma to that child that ultimately resulted in them coming into the foster care system. And so that's why that TANF conversation for us is so important. It is a prevention program. There are opportunities in TANF for us to get ahead of issues, and we feel a huge obligation to make sure that we're trying to take advantage of those opportunities. And we believe when we do that well, and we could see if you look back before our TANF caseload really started increasing and when that TANF program was better supported, there were actually fewer kids, only about 28% of whom, that were coming into the child welfare system.
Representative Olson. All right. Well, that's interesting. So you're essentially, you're kind of saying what I just heard from you, one out of three kids are possibly or potentially subject of child abuse that are in the TANF program?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, just one correction.
Okay.
So it is, so the I'm not going to do my math correctly here, but the denominator here is of the kids entering foster care, not of the kids on TANF. So of the kids entering care, 36% of them had been receiving TANF in the previous 2 months.
Yeah, okay.
So that doesn't mean that a third of kids on TANF. It's a different comparison. The other data point here, though, is just to show, and this does not is not intended to convey that families on TANF are all, that 65% of families on TANF are in the child welfare system. That's not the case. But what it's showing you is that our income level for TANF eligibility is so low, and it's actually, it was set by the same law that has set the income level for federal match in child welfare programs. And what we know is when we look at our child welfare programs, 65% of our children and families who are in child welfare would have qualified for TANF because their income is so low. Did I help clarify?
No, that did. Thank you very much.
So while we stopped, I'm starting to write something that children are 26 or 22 times more likely, and I didn't finish my sentence before you moved on and I wrote something else.
Children living in extreme poverty are 22 times more likely to experience abuse or neglect than children who are not living in poverty.
Okay, thank you. That is an astounding statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Just a minute. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, we had a very good briefing on TANF, and I would agree with you that's a prevention program, but your budget's cutting it from 50 to 30 months.
60.
Madam Chair, 60. Representative Wisnett, thank you for raising that issue. It is truly a dilemma for us. And I think when the governor announced his budget and talked about some of the significant challenges he saw in his priority for add-backs to the budget, he called out the TANF program specifically as a place where he had not been able to invest like he would have liked to have.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative. Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Erin.
So the next two slides are our celebration slides. There are good things happening in the child welfare program. We set goals around this program 4 or 5 years ago now, targeting several things. First and foremost, we have been looking to, Oregon has for a long time now enjoyed the not so positive reputation of having one of the highest removal rates into foster care in the country, top 25% of states. And we took a look at our data, we took a look at how many children per thousand were experiencing foster care in the state, and we said we think we can do better and still keep children safe. So we set goals around safely and equitably reducing our foster care population, and we have slowly but surely been meeting those goals. And this chart demonstrates over a period of time the percent reduction. Depending on the point in time you start, the number changes, but the fact of the matter is fewer children are experiencing foster care today. And at that same time, fewer children are experiencing re-abuse. This is something that we keep a close eye on. We had a slight uptick this last year that we're drilling down into, but our re-abuse rate, meaning we got a report of abuse, we substantiated it, we said yes, abuse occurred, and then 6 months later it happened again to that same child, the same experience. We're constantly evaluating our reduction effort to make sure that that we're not putting children in harm's way. And what our data is showing us is that we're still maintaining very low reabuse rates. In fact, it's been declining up until last year, our reabuse rate, and also very low reentry rates. In other words, kids are not coming back into care because we're not putting them into care in the first place. We've had a significant increase in the number of children we've been placing with relatives. This has been a big initiative for us. It's a focus on stability and connection with family. It's part of the conversation about equitable results. We changed our definition of relative with the support from the legislature. We've prioritized relatives' placements. We've been working with community partners, and we're getting results from that effort. This statistic was astounding to me. I was looking at it last night. Almost 80% of our foster care placements right now are child-specific, which means that a foster parent came forward and asked to be certified specifically to serve a child, which means that child knew that person, which therefore means that their experience in care is much different, much better, much more likely to be successful. We are serving more kids in their own home. Even after we find that abuse and neglect has occurred, we're able to safely keep them at home, and we've reinvested resources to be able to support families, to be able to avoid that trauma of removal. Being taken away from your parents, even parents that haven't treated you very well, is very traumatic. And again, we've been keeping an eye on, of course, the safety of children who are in foster care, as well as the safety of children who don't come into care. The next slide, also just some other statistics that I'm very proud of. Last year, we saw the lowest entry rate into foster care in this state in the past 5 years, a 7% decrease from 2010. That is a big deal for Oregon. And we're getting national recognition for the progress that we're making. We have a partnership with Casey Family Programs that I'll talk a little bit more about. And they highlighted Oregon in their national report this last summer as one of the states whose child welfare system is making the greatest gains. In 2011, 67% of child victims remained safely at home even after a founded incident. That means we avoided that trauma of removal. We've had a very deliberate focus on cultural specificity and making sure that as we reduce foster care, we do that equitably. That's requiring changes in our practice and in our purchasing of services. And we actually saw some really positive results for our African American population last year. They have historically been overrepresented in foster care, meaning they have a greater representation in the foster care system than they do in the general population. We're starting to see their rate of entry into foster care slow down, and in Multnomah County at an even greater rate than was the slowdown for Caucasian families, which is a very big deal. It means we're starting to catch up around that overrepresentation issue.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yes, Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since it's related, I know the overrepresentation of the Native community was even greater than African American. How are you doing on that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, we haven't seen the gains in that area that we would have hoped to. It's one of the reasons that in our budget, I think we've seen different practices. We've taken steps like we have with the African American community to partner differently with culturally specific providers. But I'm looking forward later to your conversation about the House bill you'll be considering. It's a minor issue, but some of our tribal partners are here. The bigger issue is that in our budget this biennium, the governor is proposing to bring staffing and caseload levels down for workers who are assigned to cases involving tribal children, and also proposing to increase compensation, recognizing that the workload is different for those families and that we have some additional gains we need to make there. So intentional focus, but not quite getting the traction that we would have liked to.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, thank you, and Mr. Wayburn for coming by and giving a pre-briefing. The Family Fine, I've been very supportive, and that is a great program. I have a specific question, though. If we place a child with a grandparent or a relative, is that how do you count that? Is that a foster home, or are they back with the family? And in your statistics.
Go ahead.
We don't have... in Deschutes County, Central Oregon, we're blessed to have our DHS people trained in Family Fine. And are you needing money, or is that program continuing in other parts of the state? Thank you.
Yes, Representative Tomei, or Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant. as always, the system sometimes can have complications. So if we place a child that we have custody, we place them with a relative, a grandparent, that is a foster care placement. But there are often cases, occasions where we're involved in a situation and the family can make a plan to place with a relative and we don't file a custody. It's not a subcare placement. So the answer to the question is yes, and the answer to the question is no, and I apologize for that.
Thank you.
And as far as family find, I believe that you probably have not been able to look at your email, but we forwarded you the grant that we just received that will allow us to expand family find across the state, and it also has a component around family decision making.
Thank you.
Any further questions? I have a question. So it seems to me, I remember seeing in the governor's budget that there was some extra money to make to help the agency be more culturally specific, and you're already mentioning that it's a smaller caseload with some of the children's maybe from either tribal families or from African American or other minority families. Do I remember that correctly?
Certainly, that's true. There are some targeted investments as well as there is best practice behind the differential response model, which we're looking forward to talking with you more about, that illustrates that model allows for more culturally specific practice. So it's both there are some standout investments as well as investments that are embedded within other larger transformation investments.
Great. And we'll hear more about that at a later meeting. Is that what you're saying, or today?
No. Chair Tomei, with your indulgence, a little bit of both.
Great.
Is that okay?
Perfect. Absolutely. Thank you. Go ahead. You can have it.
I do want to point out that we are struggling around the area of reunification. While the numbers are improving, our staffing levels in child welfare right now, I mean, what's remarkable about these results is that we've achieved them with staffing levels that are 33% lower than what the state and federal law would otherwise require with respect to the time it takes to actually do the work. And so what we're starting to see is some slippage in our progression of improvement as our workers are having a harder time keeping up with the work. And one of the areas where we have seen slippage in particular is around the time, the length of stay in foster care. We had a Secretary of State audit that commented on that, and one of the primary recommendations of the audit was for the legislature to seriously consider the issue of staffing and the impact that it has on moving children through the system in a way that is more responsive and respectful and doesn't have children who are in care staying there too long. The other thing that's true that I do need to point out is that in other states that have made gains with respect to relative placements, sometimes one of the outcomes of that is that children stay in foster care longer. And it's because, the family gets to spend a little more time making themselves well and healthy, and they're more comfortable with where their child is, and there are just a lot of dynamics around that. So we're keeping an eye on both. We certainly would not want to give up the best practice of relative placement in the name of more quickly moving a child through the foster care system, but we also don't want children in the system for too long. I want to also brag about your counties, because we couldn't have done any of this without that local partnership and conversation that locally is driving this. It's one thing for me as your statewide representative and bureaucrat to say, team, we need to safely and equitably reduce foster care. It's quite another thing for the branches across the state and the counties and their county partners, everything from their judges, their CASAs, their attorneys, their community partners, to say, we actually agree with DHS that's the right thing to do, and not only do we agree, but we're going to throw our weight behind it and help. And that's exactly what's happening, is that new conversations and partnerships are happening in counties, and we'll talk about that in the next couple slides. Thank you. Moving me on. I don't want to ignore that in addition to a conversation about making sure that we have a foster care system that's used appropriately, which is really what the reduction effort is about, that we also have a foster care system that functions, that is of high quality and that functions well for the children who need it, because there are children and young people who need to come into care. And so we have another set of goals around safety, health, education, and youth transition with respect to children who do experience foster care, and we are also tracking metrics. I've thrown a few on the table for you here. I mentioned earlier that our rate of abuse in foster care is extraordinarily low. Of course, any abuse in foster care is totally unacceptable. But in addition, what we did a couple of years ago with the help of our Child Welfare Advisory Committee and the Foster Youth Coalition was really drilled down into safety in foster care and what are some steps that we can take to make sure that we're doing everything possible to assure the safety of children in our care. So we've implemented different types of reviews for cases where concerns arise around foster caregiving, and also a different way of studying homes and having conversations with families who are interested in becoming foster parents. We've also seen, I mentioned this, and I was wrong, the 85% was newly certified. It's not 80% now child-specific. I flipped the number. I apologize. Correct me on the record here with this bullet point. But newly certified families, over 80% are specially certified for children, and now we have 55% of our foster parents that are child-specific. And the research documents that creates more placement stability for children as well as safer environments, as well as better connects them to their culture of origin, their family heritage, et cetera. We have taken seriously the charge around the health of kids in our care. Thank you very much for the action that this body took in order to extend the ability for youth transitioning from foster care to continue their health benefits. We've also been looking closely at the issue of psychotropic medications. We were one of a few states chosen to receive a grant because of how focused the state has been and some of the progress that we've made that you can see here. We have a strong partnership with the Oregon Health Authority around this initiative, and we'll continue to stay focused to make sure that children who need the medication receive it, but that we're not over-medicating our kids. We've got collaborations evolving around education outcomes for our kids. Again, want to credit you all for the tuition waivers around foster youth, and really credit the Foster Youth Coalition for all their advocacy and work on that. But it's clear to us that we want to partner with the 40-40-20 goals. We want to make sure that families who have an encounter with the child welfare system, and particularly children and young people who do, are school ready and are successful in school. And finally, youth transition. This is an area where, again, just full disclosure, we are very much struggling. This state has historically not invested adequately in youth transition programs, and we've been working hard with our foster youth to figure out how to make sure the dollars we do invest are spent on the things that will matter most to them, to afford them a successful transition. Mm-hmm. But that's a conversation that we expect will be ongoing as a budget conversation around how are we funding programs that support youth to make a positive transition from foster care to adulthood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ask you about this while it seems like the appropriate time. I know there's, from my experience on the Portland Children's Levy, that one of the big challenges is when kids go from foster care to foster care family, not only do they often end up in different schools, but they often end up with different health care providers. Is that a situation that you've been trying to work on at a state level?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, one of the things that's happened with the advent of the CCO conversations is it is allowing us to, we've had the school transition and actually have law that supports foster youth being able to stay in their school of origin and our responsibility to transport them there. We're now having a new conversation with the health systems transformation and the CCOs about what we might be able to do to ensure healthcare continuity for kids. Do you know anything more specific than that you want to add? Okay.
I just know there were some pilot projects with Emmanuel in Portland, so.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, I can look deeper into that and bring back more information for the committee. That'd be helpful. So I do want to just, this next slide, this is my last slide, is really about future conversation or opportunities that we see on the horizon that we're looking forward to working with you on. As I said, you know, this isn't a perfect system. We know that we have room for improvement, but we are proud of what we've accomplished, and we think we're a system that's worth investing in. We couldn't have done this without partnerships. I've mentioned that. KC Family Programs really helped, and the Commission on Children and Families helped catalyze a conversation that was different about partnerships that is ongoing today, has been going on for the last 4 years. The judicial branch is a strong partner with us in this work, as well as local community partners, county programs. It's been, I have to say, probably one of the more rewarding parts of this for me is the stories, and I told Representative Gilliam this story about the faith community. These new non-traditional partnerships, the business community, the faith community, coming to the table, having different conversations about child welfare. We had a family, a mother who was fleeing a domestic violence situation with her children. We were supporting them to live in a hotel. We were looking for housing for that individual. The individual, the mother, had no connections to family or any place else to go except back to the abuse perpetrator. If she returned to that abuser, we were going to have to remove her children and place them into foster care. We were at the end of our ability to financially support her to continue to stay in this hotel, and we were not able to secure other resources. And so one of our local branch managers, because of this community partnership work, picked up the phone and called a local pastor that he had made a connection with and said, "What would you do if you were me?" The pastor said, "Let me make a few phone calls," came back, was able to put this mother up in housing with another family that she consented to. Nobody was forced in the circumstance. And then ultimately, this individual was supported by that congregation to live in housing for 6 months so that she could get her affairs in order, become more secure on her own. And those children never had to leave their mom's side. And that was just because of that community outreach and the partnerships that our program developed. And there are thousands of other stories like that that we're very proud of. Senate Bill 964 is really the extension of that work. You passed that bill last session and challenged us to work differently across agencies and in communities in support of programs that will strengthen, preserve, and reunify families. We've implemented we've begun the implementation of that effort this biennium. We're in 7 counties right now: Clackamas, Jackson, Malheur, Multnomah, Coos, Umatilla, and Josephine. We're moving into 3 more in June. The governor's budget includes funding that would allow us to implement statewide, which is what the bill requires, that we implement statewide by 2015. Differential response is something, Madam Chair, that we do hope to be able to spend more time with you on. It's fundamentally about changing our practice at the front end of our system to think differently about how we partner when a report of abuse or neglect occurs, and it will more likely be relevant in situations involving neglect. Remember, I talked about the fact that that is a major driver of abuse in the state, and it's also the case that when we remove children for neglect, they stay in foster care longer. We want to talk with you about our proposal to change that front-end practice so that we can serve even more children at home safely. We know that we have a lot of work that we need to do with our provider partners. We can't do this without them. And these other bullets here just highlight for you some of where we're going. And to transition to your next conversation, I'll just come back to that Indian Child Welfare Act compliance and our partnership with our sovereign nations and tribes here locally. In the state, we do have a federal law that mandates compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act. It sets different standards, and it's based on a long history that has been very negative for the tribes around their interaction with child welfare, government child welfare systems. We take that responsibility really seriously, and we're very excited that the governor's budget supports us differently in that respect, and we're looking forward to that conversation with you as well.
Erin, have you implemented yet having DV workers in every child welfare office?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. We do have co-located domestic violence advocates now. They're not in every office, I don't believe, but they are statewide. There was a statewide implementation. The funding, I don't know if you remember this, but the funding ultimately, as the budget was negotiated, was reduced slightly and couldn't implement the every office approach. But we did, we do have co-located domestic violence advocates in many offices, and we are in every one of our districts, not every county, but we divide our service delivery into 16 districts, and so we wanted to make sure that every district would benefit from that co-location. We could definitely provide the committee with an update on that if you'd be interested.
That would be terrific. I have to go to another committee for just a few minutes, but those of us who've been on Judiciary Committee, we talk a lot about how much it costs to keep people in prison, and it's cheaper to send them to a state university. And I was thinking about the children who go into foster care, mm-hmm. that probably, and people who are in extreme poverty, we would probably be better off helping those families rather than putting those children in foster care financially as well as certainly humanely. So I apologize for leaving. Representative Olson will chair the meeting for a while.
Representative, was it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, again, thank you for all your work and success. It's a big hill to climb, and I hope you keep climbing. Couple of programs that I'm still trying to get my hands around of who's in charge and trying to look at the organizational command and structure. We have a kids center in Central Oregon that abused children go to, you know, and that's called different things and different people. I think I forgot what Salem's is. Is that under you? Who's in charge of that? because that's child welfare to me, that's child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We take it in with a doctor and a nurse that, you know, handles that. And also, we have a program called Mary's House, where it's a place where the father and mother, who the courts have ordered to be separated, can come and have time with the child under supervision. Are you familiar with that program? Who controls that? Where does that fall now under this new structure?
Representative Olson, Chair Olson, I'm sorry, Representative Wisnant. The Child Abuse Assessment Centers are not in my organization. The financing, they're nonprofit entities from my, they're independent, but financing for them does come through the Department of Justice. And so you're right. I mean, you're pointing out the complexity of a system designed to support children. Those centers partner with us regularly to ensure that when children need to be interviewed, especially when there's the potential for law enforcement prosecution, that those interviews happen in an objective, fair, and child-specific, child-sensitive way. So do you want to add anything to that about the care centers?
Yes, Chair Olson and Representative Wisnant, I apologize. The care centers are generally, of course, working closely with your MDTs, and so there's often a connection between them, not just with child welfare in terms of their investigation, but also the attempts at vertical prosecution of cases when there's criminal charges that are involved. And their MDTs closely connected with their performance in terms of oversight. There are nonprofits connected to that.
And Chair Olson, Representative Wisnant, I'm not familiar with Mary's House, but what it sounds like is that it may be connected to the child support program, child custody situations where supervised visitation needs to occur. I don't know. That would be through the court. The court would order in a custody situation that kind of supervised visits, or could order that. And we are not involved in all child custody situations. Some of our hardest child welfare issues can arise during child custody situations, but there are many more of those than there are of our involvement.
Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes. Thank you for those answers for both of you. Committee, I'd just like, I think it should be on the record, that here's two other programs that were under the Commission for Children and Families for supervision, for helping to leverage funds, and I don't know who the director answered, honestly, that's under her, but I'm not sure who's picking up these responsibilities, and I'll try to find out from the courts, and I'll try to find out from the other one, but that's another example of how we've got services in the community that I'm not sure that our new organization of Early Learning Center and all that is going to not create gaps to service to the most needy people out in our community. So thank you. It's a comment for the record.
Okay. Representative Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have two quick points I'd like to make, and since Representative Tomei's out of the room, I get a chance to make them. The first is, I thank you for retelling that story about the faith-based group that was helping, particularly in this case of child abuse. I appreciate you sharing that with the larger committee. But I wanted to make the point that we had a hearing last session with the help and support of our chair, seriously, just around what the faith community, what nonprofits, what other kind of independent agencies were doing, not just in child welfare, but in all of human services. And it was a really good hearing. As we move on, I wanted to suggest, and I'll certainly suggest it to the chair, I mentioned it to her before the session, that we do that again because of our new, although Representative Gelser and the chair are not new to the committee in the sense you've already served, but with the new makeup, I think you all would have some good nominees. What we did, we asked the committee to showcase, if possible, some organizations are too far away, those kind of communities that can add this kind of plus to the equation that the director spoke of. So as we move on and get through maybe the heavier sledding of our agenda, maybe we can do that again. And I would invite you to start thinking about that, and I'll mention that to the chair. Lastly, I would move, Mr. Chair, that we cut Fridays out of our session, out of our committee
second
for the
motion.
Rest of the session.
Second.
You know what? That's not a motion. We don't have seconds on that, and it's okay, so let's move on.
Just a try.
Okay. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jeez.
I've been doing that all day long. So first of all, I just really wanted to thank you, Aaron, for your leadership at DHS. I think if for those of us that have been here for a while, child welfare really had some tough flooding for a while, and I think your leadership and Brian Johnston's before you has really been instrumental to making Oregon a safer and better place for really vulnerable kids. And I think one of the hallmarks of your leadership, and I think Brian's certainly included this as well, is how candid you are, how direct you are, and that ability when something goes wrong for a kid to just say, it's not acceptable that this happened and we're going to find a way to fix it. I think that's a really refreshing response from a state. And I think when you had talked about that partnership from counties, I think leadership makes a big difference in that happening. I think people hear that they have leadership that cares about kids, that wants to find a way that makes it happen for kids in a way that works. And I think the message behind that is that you trust in your staff, that you trust in those people, those frontline workers that we don't get to hear the great things about every day. Because when you say it's not acceptable, we're going to make it work, it means you know you have the people that can make it happen. So thank you for that leadership and trusting the really good people that are out there to take care of our kids every day.
Mr. Chair.
And then I had a question, too. We got more information from you today about the presentation that you gave previously, and you had talked about the opportunities ahead. And one of the disconnects is that there's this great news about the 18% safe reduction in children experiencing foster care in Oregon. But at the same time, in your other foster care program over in DD for kids, there's been a 17.3% increase in kids moving out of the home. And I'm wondering if for those kids it isn't also very traumatic to be separated from their parents who have not abused or neglected them, and what kinds of conversations are happening at the department to take the successes of the child welfare program and maybe transfer those over to the DD program to more safely keep kids with their families rather than moving them out of care, out of home, oftentimes permanently.
Representative Olson, Representative Gelser, Senator Chair Olson, thank you for the question. We have not only started conversations, but the application for the new children's waiver that has started through the Office of Developmental Disability Services really was spearheaded by a conversation, by work that had been, I think that the program had been hoping to do for a long time, but also work that was really brought to the forefront as we started really having those cross-program discussions between child welfare and developmental disability services. So we, the idea, and Bruce Baker is here if you wanted to get more into more specifics, but the idea behind the waiver is to create more support for families and avoid the foster care placement if we can by just better supporting families in the first place. And there's an entire agenda that I think you'll hear from the developmental disability programs that talks about the importance of families and the importance of being of the state being able to recognize that we really have historically under-resourced our family support infrastructure for children with developmental disabilities. So we not only have been talking about it and looking at the data in a different way, but also taking action around the application for this children's waiver. The other place we've spent time thinking about developmental disability services, frankly, is with children who have been placed in foster care and they have been given the designation of permanent foster care. We recently went, not recently, it was probably 2 years ago, but I have to tell you, I forgot that I had been the director of the department for 2 years. I thought it was just one, so this is kind of where my disconnect in time has been. But about 2.5, 3 years ago, we went through a really intentional process of reviewing those permanent foster care cases in Oregon and looking at why do kids get assigned to permanent foster care. It was never intended to be relied upon like it is in this state. And what we found, we solicited from our frontline staff, bring us some of your hardest cases. We want to problem solve with you. We want to have, we had culturally specific providers at the table. We had people around the table from Casey Family Programs nationally saying, what could we do to get these kids into permanency? Because foster care was never supposed to be permanent. What we found is that a significant number, and I don't have the data with me today, of cases that are that our child welfare workers brought to the table were children with developmental disabilities, and they were saying to us, these children should not be in foster care. And so we created a different conversation. Kevin George is here, Bruce Baker's here, about, you know, what is the issue, what are the barriers, not just to keeping children safely at home who have developmental disabilities, but also for children who have not benefited from that effort, who are in care, to be able to go home or to go to something more permanent. We're not there yet, but it is an active conversation, not just a conversation, but action-oriented.
Just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead, follow-up.
Thank you. And Erin, I hadn't realized that Bruce was in the back of the room. I think in the line of thanks, I know I had a constituent who had a child that had been placed out of home voluntarily during a crisis. They couldn't get that kid home. We contacted Bruce, and that kid was home with his family the next week and is still thriving at home. Mm-hmm. And that family is extraordinarily grateful and continues to say wonderful things about Bruce Baker for helping that family be together, which is how they want to be. And that kid is safer and healthier. So I'm grateful for the really dedicated staff that you have over there and all of your programs that I know really think individually about the clients that you serve, not just as numbers, but as real children and real parents and real families. We are really lucky in Oregon to have the team that you've put together over there. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just wanted to second Representative Gillian's comment about, you know, the faith-based support. You know, I spent 20 years affiliated with Catholic Charities in Portland, of which Rose Haven was one of our spinoffs, and you know, I mean, obviously making a great contribution. And I just heard from Catholic Community Services of Salem, and they've got a project that they're looking at as well related to foster care. But I just want to say I think, and it's appropriate that publicly we, you know, you shoulder the burden of responsibility with foster care. But again, I liked what you were saying about the partnerships, and if we can anyway help those kinds of relationships and partnerships, I think that'd be very useful.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Erin, Jerry, thank you very much. We're going to close the informational hearing, and we're going to open up a public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2053.
Yeah. Great.
And here, Regina, we'll let you get started on that.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
If we're between things, would it be an appropriate time?
Let's wait till we get out of this for this hearing.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good point. Okay, all right, here we go. If I could have Harry Gilmore and Cheryl Kennedy come up.
Thank you, Chair Olson. My name is Harry Gilmore. I manage the Interstate Compact and Contracts Unit for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2053. This measure would make it possible for Oregon tribes to conduct the background checks that are a necessary component of ensuring the safety and well-being of children in foster care. Many Oregon tribes have their own foster care programs, and as part of that, they certify foster homes to care for children who are in care due to abuse or neglect. And part of the certification process or the licensing process for a foster home is a background check. What this bill will do is it ensure that the tribes can conduct a type of background check that is the most comprehensive. It's a nationwide fingerprint-based background check through the FBI. This is the best way to ensure that foster parents are properly screened with regard to criminal history. And it's also a background check that's required by changes in the federal code in recent years that now require a nationwide check for anybody who provides foster care in a foster care program that's supported by Title IV-E funds provided by the federal government. And that's true of all the tribes that have foster care programs in the state. The bill accomplishes this in two ways. Right now, tribes are able to conduct background checks for a number of different purposes, specifically for screening folks that work in the gaming industry, also folks who are employed with child welfare organizations within tribes, but it doesn't specifically authorize checks on folks who provide foster care, because in most cases they're not considered employees because they don't receive a wage or a salary. They're compensated most of the time for the care they provide, but that's different from an employee-employer relationship. So the tribe makes a, the bill makes a slight modification to ORS 181-538 to add foster parents to that list of individuals that the tribes can conduct a background check on. The other thing it does is it makes it possible for the Department of Human Services to conduct background checks on behalf of tribes if tribes elect to use our process, if they don't already have an established background check process within their own organization. We think this is a method that will ensure these checks can occur and also ensure compliance with the federal code that requires checks of this nature. That's the bill in a nutshell, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We'll move on. Cheryl.
Good afternoon. My name is Cheryl Kennedy. I'm with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Tribal Council. I'm here to support House Bill 2053. We have the written information that we provided to you all that's there before you. Just a part of the background, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde is located close here to Salem. We're about 35 miles west of Salem here. We were a terminated tribe back in the 1950s, which basically meant that the ties were severed with the federal government back in 1954 under the Western Oregon Termination Act. And with that, it also took away our ability to be recognized as an Indian tribe in the United States. But back in 1983, we were restored, and with it, all of our rights were intact as well. In those early years, of course, the tribe was working on its own constitution and some of the sovereignty issues that were before us. Having served on our first tribal council back in the early 30s or early 80s, we were very concerned about our children and remain to be concerned today. Prior to my working with my own tribe, I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I helped other tribes back in the 1970s on the passage of the Indian Child Welfare Act. And it was a movement that was very strong, and all tribes of the United States were suffering equally without the Indian Child Welfare Act. And our main concern was that the heritage and the culture identity of our children remain intact, and that was not what was happening. And so the Indian Child Welfare Act was introduced and was passed. So one of the first undertakings the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde took on concerning child welfare was to establish an ordinance, and we did that. We formed a committee that reviewed all of the interactions of our children that were under the auspices of the state agency at that time. And we engaged and sometimes asserted our rights because we were not always welcomed in those venues. But as we acquired more and more resources, we were able to make sure that some of the services that you heard described in the earlier presentation, we started employing those preventative services. Termination has a devastating effect on a people. One of the first things that are attacked is your identity. You hear about all of the ills and the social ills that come from classes of people in general. It's very important that you have an identity. And when you're removed from your identity and put with others who do not possibly celebrate your identity, many things traumatically happen. So the tribe has invested a lot of resources into making sure that our children have a bright future. As appalling as the statistics are concerning Native Americans, we do believe that in working together in this collaborative way that we're able to make sure that some of the traumatizing effects will be reduced when we're able to access the thorough background checks that are required for setting up foster homes. It's very important that children, when they are go through one trauma, that's the removal of their family, that they not have to endure any more in a potential foster home that they're going into. And so we really support this bill and ask that you support it as well. I have with you today, I want to introduce Dana Einem, who is our Indian Child Welfare Manager for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Does a terrific job, is very sensitive and works with the staff of the state and in our counties in terms of protecting our children. So with that, you can read what I have in there, but I thought that it's very important that the committee understand there are 9 tribes in Oregon and every one of us are different. So, but this is a unified effort. This will do good for all of us. Thank you.
Sure. Appreciate that. Any questions?
Sure.
Representative Gallegos.
I just want to say I'm very honored to have you here today and want to thank you for the pioneering work. I know people appreciate 1973. That was amazing, amazing work to create that Indian Child Welfare Act. And it came from our people here in the Northwest.
Yes,
that's great.
It did.
So thank you. I just want to speak in favor of the effort as well, just to recognize that, you know, some tribes are more fortunate than others, and that this particular piece of legislation really sort of levels out the field and really helps all the tribes then to achieve this particular piece of activity. So thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Harry, thank you very much. Cheryl, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can we close a public hearing and possible work session on this House Bill 2053? And Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still hung up on that Friday question that was presented a few minutes ago.
So we have to move on.
All right. Well, just a second. Actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to suspend the rules to allow Representative Whitsitt to vote on 2082, 2165, and 2676, and also to suspend the rules so that Representative Kenny Geyer can vote on 2082. I'm not certain if anybody else here missed any votes earlier in the gathering today.
Okay, well, we'll start with Representative Whitsitt first. Okay, so... Committee members, Representative Gomberg has moved to suspend the rules to reopen work sessions, separate work sessions on House Bill 2076. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so we'll open up a work session, a reopen one on House Bill 2082. Representative Wizard, how do you vote?
Yes.
She votes yes, and we close a work session.
No, keep it open.
Oh, we'll come back.
Okay.
We'll come back. Okay. House Bill, I'm going to reopen a work session on House Bill 2165. And Representative Whitsitt, how do you vote on that?
Me.
Okay. I'm going to close a work session on 2165, and now I'm going to reopen a work session on House Bill 2676. And how do you vote?
Yay.
She votes yay. And we'll close a work session on House Bill 2676. Also, Representative Gomberg has moved to suspend the rules to reopen a work session on House Bill 2082 to allow Representative Kenny Geyer to vote. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so done. So we're going to reopen a work session on House Bill 2082. Representative Kenny Geyer, how do you vote?
Aye.
She votes aye. And we close a work session on that House Bill 2082. All right, that comes to the end. Is there anything else? Chair Tomei is gone. All right, that's good. We're adjourned.
Friday.
And the Friday thing.